Happy Father's Day to all of you. And, yeah, right. Yeah, me too. All right. Okay. Oh, I have a father-in-law I have to cook for, so, yeah. As long as you got a father, it's really not Father's Day. And then when you are in that position, then you really appreciate people taking care of you. That's good. Well, I just got back from back east where we did kind of a media tour. I saw this huge billboard there. Father's Day. It's his day. His only day. So that was cute. Yep. We spent most of last week, Fuzz and I, in Indiana and Illinois, doing radio and TV interviews. And the main thing was that we had done a couple of interviews about a year and a half ago where they were really anxious for the multi-language version of Journey Toward Creation. And so it got released, I think, Friday. But we had a couple of advanced copies that we kind of put together and presented that to them. But the TV opportunities we had were great. I mean, I thought we were only going to get a few minutes on this hour-long show. They gave us the entire hour. And they asked us to sit for another half hour for a news show. And I was expecting just a few minutes on that, and they gave us a whole half hour. So those networks back there like us. And what's good is the networks we were on are predominantly overseas. They have about 15 stations each here in America, but much more exposure overseas. And they were really thrilled to get this. In fact, I think we got a few copies here today. 12 languages we now have Journey Toward Creation available in. Many of them dubbed, and many of them dubbed and subtitled as well. But this one group, Harvest TV, they said that we could probably get 1 billion people to watch our DVD. And they said right away they're going to get it aired in Arabic throughout the Muslim world. And then they'll follow it up with a Hindi. Hindi was an afterthought for us, but when we realized how many hundreds of millions of people speak Hindi, we decided to put that in there. And they were really excited about getting it in Hindi. And in fact, they may air it in all 12 languages. And we also had the same response at the TCT. Night before last, Saturday morning, I was on KKLA for their 2-hour special that runs from midnight to 2 in the morning. I had no idea how many people were up that late. I mean, the thing was just flooded with calls. So we were taking calls from all over during that time slot. And a lot of people were up, and that was fun. A lot of controversy. It seems like all the... I think it's kind of like that show that's on... What is it? Art Bell Show. This is the Art Bell Show for Christians. So they bring up all these strange ideas. We get to talk about them. And that was quite fun. Hey, before we get into our study on what the Bible says about general revelation, see if we can finish it up today, I did want to tell you about a new scientific discovery. And this discovery is born out of the frustration of trying to find a planet outside of our solar system that can support life. They now got a little more than 190 planets they have found outside of our solar system. But every single planet that they have found is a provable non-candidate to house a planet like Earth that could possibly support life. They're mainly finding planets the size of Jupiter or larger. But the problem is you have to have Jupiter of just the right size and just the right location if you're going to have a planet that can possibly sustain life and advanced life in particular. And of all the planets they have found, none of them would permit that possibility. And so there's been some speculation in the scientific literature that maybe Earth is an anomaly. Life doesn't really exist on planets. It exists on moons. And so the enthusiasm is now shifted away from trying to find a planet that can support life to finding a moon that can support life. You say, well, what's driving that? What's driving that is that they're finding a disproportionate number of gas giant planets that are orbiting relatively close to their stars. You know, it started off where we thought that was a selection effect. We now realize it's more than just a selection effect, because now that we've got the instruments to find more distant Jupiters, they're not really coming out like we thought. And there's been some theoretical calculations where they would actually predict that most of the gas giants indeed would drift in towards our stars. All gas giants must form far away from the stars. It takes a cold temperature to form a gas giant, but if there's any residual gas in the planetary system, the gas giant will interact with that gas, and it causes the planet to drift in towards its star. So that kind of explains why we're finding so many of these gas giants close to their stars. However, it has sparked some hope in those who are looking for a naturalistic explanation for life, because they're saying, well, what if we have a Jupiter or a bigger planet orbiting around the Sun at about the distance that Earth orbits around our star? And we're finding lots of Jupiters outside of our solar system that have that approximate orbit. And they said if there's a moon going around that planet, then maybe life could exist on that moon. So that's been the kind of the hope of the naturalistic community. Well, in the very latest issue of Nature, this came out Friday, there's an article by a couple of very well-known astronomers, Robin Knoop and William Ward. And they've been spending most of their time looking at the exquisite design of the moon-forming event. You know the story that's in this thing, Journey Toward Creation, where you got a Mars-sized planet that collides with the Earth very early in its history, and that leads to the formation of the moon and the development of conditions on planet Earth that make life possible on planet Earth. That's the key event for transforming the poisonous atmosphere of the Earth into an atmosphere that would permit life to exist. Well, these two people have teamed up to look at another problem, and that is, how do you explain moons around gas giants? And the thing they've done in this research paper is they look at the gas giants in our solar system, and they notice that every one of them has a total mass of moons that's about 1/10,000th the mass of the planet. You know, it doesn't matter whether it's Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, or Jupiter, you get the same answer. And so they're saying, is there some fundamental physical reason why the masses of the moons orbiting the gas giants in our solar system come in at 1/10,000th the total mass? And actually, Earth is the only exception to that. I mean, if you look at the planets that are rocky, it's also about that same ratio. I mean, the only one that's got moons besides the Earth is Mars, but it's got these two tiny moons that come in at under 1/10,000th, a lot under 1/10,000th. So what they're surmising here is that perhaps there's a reason why the mass of the moons cannot get above 1/10,000th. And the whole paper is they discovered what that reason is. And, you know, how you form moons, they're just like you get kind of a gas dust disk around a star that leads to the formation of the planets. Likewise, you get a gas dust disk around gas giants that leads to the formation of the moons around those things. And so what they point out is that the formation of moons around a gas giant is basically a two-way battle. The gas and the dust will coagulate to make those moons, but at the same time, that gas and dust interacts with the moons to cause them to drift in towards their planet. So just like gas giants will interact with the gas and dust in the stellar system and drift in towards a star, likewise, in their simulations or computer simulations, they show that the moons around gas giants will likewise drift in towards the star. But what's most interesting is they discovered that the greater the mass of the moon, the more it will drift in, or the faster it will drift into its planet. And there's a certain limit. Once the moon reaches a certain critical mass, then it drifts in very quickly towards its gas giant, which means it gets destroyed. And so that explains why we don't get moons bigger than a certain size. And they conclude the paper by saying the best we can hope for in terms of moons orbiting around gas giants would be moons about the mass of Mars. Now that would mean you'd have, say, a planet that would be 5 to 10 times the mass of Jupiter, and at 5 to 10 times the mass of Jupiter, it can produce a planet as big as Mars. But a planet as big as Mars is not big enough to be a place where life can possibly exist. You have to be about the size of the Earth, no bigger, no smaller, for life to be possible. Mars is only being 1/9 the mass of the Earth is not a candidate for life. But that being the case, that means all moons everywhere have been ruled out as candidates for life. Yes. Well, life on Europa, I mean, what they're looking for is bacterial life in the supposed ocean that lies below the surface of Europa. And as I wrote in Origins of Life, we already know it's a forlorn hope. And the reason why is we know that the ice has a certain minimum thickness. It must be at least 26 kilometers thick, and if it's 26 kilometers thick, oxidants that are on the surface of Europa will not be able to worm their way down to the liquid water ocean that might lie below. The ice is simply too thick for the oxidants to get down there. You say, why is that important? Because if you have life underneath those ice shell, it needs an energy source. And a photosynthesis isn't going to work, and so you're going to need to have some oxidants. And if the oxidants can't get down there, then there's nothing to sustain the metabolism of the life. Therefore, life on Europa is impossible. However, that hasn't dampened the enthusiasm much for NASA going to Europa to drill a hole through the ice and look for life there. In fact, I've already made a suggestion to NASA scientists that the first thing they ought to do is put a satellite in orbit around Europa. That can be done for a few million dollars. Whereas the project to drill through the ice in Europa and drop down a movie camera to look for bacteria, that's a minimum of $2 billion. And I'd be surprised if they could do it for less than $4 billion. Whereas $100 million or maybe even less would be enough to put a satellite around Europa. You say, why would you want to do that? Well, it's still not clear today whether the orbit of Europa is eccentric enough to drive tidal heating that would cause the water below the surface of Europa to melt. Now, it could be frozen ice all the way down. And if it's frozen ice all the way down, then I think we can safely conclude you're not going to find life there. But we already know you can't find life there because of the oxidant problem. But I notice the oxidant problem doesn't seem to be dampening enthusiasm. But, I mean, in terms of trying to be efficient with the taxpayers' money, I'd say it'd be worthwhile to spend a maximum of $100 million to first find out whether there's even water there. Yeah. Wasn't exactly captured. It was formed as a result of a collision, right? Well, that's an extremely unlikely event. I mean, the probability of that kind of event happening is below one chance in a trillion, trillion, trillion. It did happen on planet Earth. I use that as a piece of evidence that the moon-forming event was not a natural accident. The fine-tuning involved and the probability of even happening, period, is so utterly remote that I think you're justified in saying this is more than just a coincidence. So, nor in the scientific literature are they claiming that this is a common event and is a way that we could have a moon big enough going around a gas giant. By the way, I'm going to go to the blackboard and show you why it's not possible even if you had a big moon. Okay? So let's check this out.
This is hard to come by these days.
Got it. Right.
I mean, you know, PowerPoint is pretty easy to have a piece of chocolate. Okay. I think you've got a big planet here. Lots of mass. And you've got another moon orbiting it, but it's quite large. The mass of the gas giant will be so large that it will cause a differential tidal force. You say, what does that mean? I think you all remember that gravity is stronger when the objects are closer together. And so what gravity of the gas giant will do is pull a little more strongly on this side of the planet or the moon, and it would the opposite side. And what that does is it slows down the rotation rate of the moon. In fact, this is what happened to the Earth-Moon system. The gravity of the Earth is so strong on the near side relative to the far side of the moon that it's causing the rotation to force it to rotate with the same period around which it revolves. And so the moon has a rotation rate of 29 days, but it's identical to its revolution around the Earth. So it means that the moon has the same size towards Earth at all times. So whenever you look at the moon, you're looking at the same size, and it's quite tightly locked. Well, Jupiter with a planet the same size as Earth, or say you get a planet that's 10 times the size of Jupiter and a planet the size of the Earth, it will be tidally locked, unless it's far away. Now, if it's tidally locked, you've got problems, because a planet that big is going to have a radiation coming out, and Jupiter's strong radiation, and what that does is just going to get the planet, so you don't want it tidally locked. However, if you push it far enough away that it's not tidally locked, now you've got an orbit around the gas giant, which would force the moon to be close to the sun on one side of the orbit and far from the sun on the other side of the orbit. You say, well, does that make a difference in the physical orbit? Yes, it does, because, say, with planet Earth, if you were to move it 0.4% closer or 1% farther away, that's enough to get rid of all the water on Earth. Say, 1% farther away turns all the water. So it makes 0.4% closer and enough to turn all the water into a vapor state. So to avoid the tidal locking, you're now forced to put the planet so far away that it's going to get a lot more heat from this part of the orbit.
So in that sense, you could argue that this paper wasn't even necessary. We already knew that moon candidates that were realistic simply would not provide the conditions that would make life possible and certainly advance life. But this is a breakthrough, and it puts an actual limit on the mass of any moon orbiting a planet. Yes. Well, the expectation before we found planets outside the solar system is that the solar system would prove to be common. And all the planets we discovered outside the solar system are proving the opposite. We're finding no solar system analogs. And what I mean are analogs that are good enough that it would permit at least the existence of bacterial life. That we're not finding. And so it's confirming what's called the rare Earth hypothesis. Well, the feeling was that all planets form the same way through aggregating gas and dust. The feeling now is that the solar system is exceptional because the gas and dust disappeared quite quickly. And that explains why our gas giants did not migrate inward to the degree that we see in other star systems. And so we had a rapid formation. You say, well, how could you get a rapid formation? Well, if you have lots of pebbles relative to the gas and dust, you do get a more rapid formation. And having lots of pebbles could explain the nature of the inner solar system planets. So there are some astronomers who think that the typical planetary system in the universe is one with gas giants without rocky inner planets. The assumption's always been, if you got the gas giants, you're going to have the rocky inner planets. Well, maybe, but maybe not. So they now have, you know, these two different ways of forming planets. But one thing they do know is the pebble route would be rare. The gas dust route is quite common. So, but we won't know for sure until we're actually finding planets that are the size of the Earth or smaller. Right now, the limit is they've found one planet that's three times the mass of the Earth. And we do have the technology to discover planets as small as the Earth through the transit method. So far we haven't found any, but they've been looking now for 3 years. Okay, in the back, John. It would if you're talking bacteria. With bacteria, you can get a little more toleration because you're right. What you can do with bacteria is come up with a very heavy atmosphere that would trap a lot of heat, which means you'd want to have the gas giant farther away with the moon orbiting it, which would make it less sensitive to the problem we're explaining over here. But now you're dealing with a high-pressure atmosphere, which does limit the kinds of life forms you can have on that planet. Okay, what you're referring to is the fact that the water absorbs heat and lets it go quite slowly. And so water is a good ameliorator of heat differences, which explains why the ocean, for example, has less temperature differentiation than the continental land masses. So yeah, I mean, we could consider a water world with no continents at all, and if you got lots of water, it will help even out these temperature differences, but it won't work if you got tidal locking. Because with tidal locking, you're going to have significant periods of time where it's facing the star and significant periods of time when it's not facing the star. And also, if the planet has a magnetic field, then you're going to get particle spallation of the atmosphere. And if you have just one part of the atmosphere being exposed to the planet at all times, that would be quite destructive, and that would get rid of your nice water vapor blanket. So... But yeah, if you're talking bacterial life, you can broaden the constraints a little bit. If you're talking advanced life, they're quite a bit narrower. Yes. Eventually, the Earth will be tidally locked, but it's going to take a long time. And actually, the Moon will tidally lock with the Earth first. That will occur first. And you say, how much time we're talking about? We now know that 40 billion years from now, the Earth will be tidally locked to the Moon, and about 40 billion years thereafter, it will be tidally locked to the Sun. So it will happen, but it's going to be a while before it happens. And actually, if you're concerned about disasters, there's this one. Once the Earth and the Moon become tidally locked, then instead of the Moon spiraling away from the Earth, it now reverses and spirals toward the Earth. So 80 billion years from now, you've got the Moon colliding with the Earth. But actually, the Sun will incinerate both objects before that happens. So, yeah. In terms of astronomical disasters, we can think of lots of things that can be nasty for us if you're willing to give us a billion years. Yes. Well, I actually got a press release out on that. I got it out on Friday. And the reason that got such attention is from whom it came from, Stephen Hawking. Stephen Hawking was in Hong Kong, and I heard that he was given a reception that was greater than what Michael Jackson would have gotten if he had been there. The whole city was really very excited about him being there, and he had a press release. In his press release, he explained that we are doomed. I mean, I just mentioned some of the things that could wipe us out, like the Moon colliding with us in 80 billion years. But Stephen Hawking actually went on to explain relatively short-term disasters that would make this planet uninhabitable. And he says, given that it's inevitable that's going to happen, and happen relatively soon on a cosmic scale, we need to start investing heavily in trying to find another home. Earth is not going to support us much longer. We got to find another place. Well, what I've mentioned in the press release is that Hawking is right. And he's not the first astronomer to point out that we cannot live on this planet a whole lot longer. And if our hope is, our destiny is focused on planet Earth, then we are without hope and we are without destiny. But the Christian worldview is that our hope does not lie on planet Earth, or for that matter in the universe. And by the way, Hawking didn't mention this. Not only is planet Earth doomed for future human life support, that's also true of the entire universe. So his mission of trying to find another place where we can go, that too is doomed. In a relatively brief period of time on a cosmic scale, the entire universe becomes uninhabitable. And that's really the guts of the press release that we put out, is that, you know, Hawking's right, but it's much worse than what he said. The whole universe is ruled out. But the thing about the human species is that we're compelled to seek after some kind of eternal ultimate destiny. And where did that come from? Why does every human being have that drive, and why is it even stronger within us than the drive for self-preservation? And that's one of many arguments I could give scientifically, that we really do possess an ultimate hope and an ultimate destiny. Given that we can scientifically prove this, independent of the Bible, that we do have an ultimate destiny, and given that that ultimate destiny can't possibly lie within the universe, it must lie beyond. And that's where Christianity comes in. What's unique about Christianity, it's the one religion, the only religion, that presents us with a two-creation model. The first creation, the universe in which we live, God creates to bring about the conquest and the removal of evil. And once evil is gone, then this universe will have fulfilled its purpose, and it replaces this universe with a brand new universe. And somehow I managed to say all that in a one-page press release. But actually what I did is I referred them to our stuff where we actually go into this in a little more detail. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, I heard they just released a video on the helium proof for an old, for a young universe. Okay, well, I'll go off topic, then we'll pick up the questions that are on topic, but very quickly to address your issue. Yeah, I think what was unfortunate about that event at EV3 is the fact that there wasn't really a Q&A time. The questions were all pre-sifted, and mainly from the committee rather than from the audience. And also, there was no opportunity for any of us who were speakers to respond to the other material, even answer questions about the other material. But I have addressed this in a matter of days, making the point that the only people that use helium to date the Earth or the universe are the younger creationists. And the reason why no one else uses it as a dating method, it's the poorest of all the elements you could pick in the atomic chart to date anything. And the reason why is helium, and by the way, this is admitted by the young Earth creationists, helium, as you'll see in their writings, is a very slippery molecule. And anyone who's done work with helium, and I have done research work with helium, the big problem is trying to keep it in its container. I mean, it'll get through anything, and especially in the liquid state. It actually runs up the edges of the flask and down the other side. And, you know, this stuff costs $1 a liter, and we were graded on how much helium we had left over after our experiment was over. And that was really kind of a mark of the skill we had in trying to keep that helium in. But it can diffuse into anything, it can diffuse out. And so trying to measure how much helium is left in a zircon crystal and use that to date the Earth, from my perspective, is absurd. Because helium can easily escape, it can easily penetrate. And the other problem with helium is not all of it's radiogenic. You know, the assumption that they're making is that the helium that's there comes from the decay of uranium and thorium. Well, that's where much of the helium comes from. But in terms of the universe and the atmosphere beyond Earth, and that's what they're really measuring, is the amount of helium escaping the Earth's atmosphere. Well, the vast majority, 95% of the helium in the universe, is not radiogenic. It comes from the Big Bang. It does not come from the decay of radiometric elements. It comes from the fusion of hydrogen. The universe is 25% helium. And the reason why it's 25% helium is not because of radiometric decay. It's because that helium came out of the Big Bang creation event. Mind you, they don't believe in the Big Bang creation event, so I don't know exactly what they say about helium. But, you know, given that mostly helium is not radiogenic, again, trying to measure the quantity of helium gives you a poor insight into how much helium is decayed and therefore how old the system would be. Yes. Stars will make a little bit of helium. The universe makes most of it. The stars, of all the helium in the universe, stars contribute maybe 2%. Okay? Because, and the universe makes the most. But again, the stuff made in stars is not radiogenic. It's made from the fusion of hydrogen. And so you get all this helium floating around, and it diffuses in and out of things very freely, and therefore helium really is useless as an age-dating tool. Now, compare that with argon. 100% of the argon in the Earth's atmosphere comes from radiogenic decay. It comes from the decay of potassium-40. And so you could look at the argon in the Earth's atmosphere and use that as a tool for how old the Earth's atmosphere is. The Earth's atmosphere is 1% argon. That's a lot of argon, which adds up to several billion years of radiometric decay of potassium to account for that argon. Now, unlike helium, argon is 100% radiogenic. Also, unlike helium, it's a heavy element. It does not move around well. I mean, it's heavier than carbon dioxide. And so it just kind of sits there. It's a little bit less than, it's 40. I think carbon dioxide's 42. You can work out the chemistry. But nevertheless, being such a heavy element, it sits close to the surface. And so again, it doesn't diffuse like helium does, so it's a good marker for the age of the Earth. And by the way, before the discovery of radiometric dating tools, argon in the 19th century was a tool for dating the age of the moon and dating the age of the Earth. And that's where they first got the clue that we're looking at billions of years because of the quantity of argon. But today, no one uses argon to date things because we have better tools. And in terms of exactly what they were doing in this rate study, this younger study, is they were looking at uranium-235, uranium-238, and thorium-232. And they decay into three different kinds of lead, lead-206, 207, and 208, and helium. Well, they ignored the lead, they ignored the uranium and the thorium, and only looked at the helium. Now, how physicists date things, date rocks and date the Earth, is they measure the quantity of uranium-235 that's still left, 238 that's still left, and thorium-232. And because they decay at different rates, very different rates, the quantities that are left over in the sample tells you how old the sample is. And then to check it, you can measure the quantity of lead-206, 207, and 208. The thorium-232 decays into the 208, the uranium-238 into the 207, and the 235 decays into the 206. So this gives you six independent tools based on the same process for dating the sample. And all of these things diffuse very slowly in the sample. So they're stable within the sample, and I think this is what's causing the scientific community to be so upset with these young Earth creationists. Here we've got six very reliable tools, all giving us the same answer. They ignore that, and they focus on the one method that has no credibility or reliability. Now, it would have been nice if that could have been explained at the conference, but... Now, it is in the book of Matter Days. Yeah, it's in A Matter of Days, and it's in the chapter where it's either the chapter where we critique the young Earth scientific tools, or it's in the chapter where we talk about ways scientifically for measuring the age of the Earth. I think it's in the chapter where we critique their tools. And it's similar to the polonium argument. You know how they focus on polonium halos, but they ignore the uranium halos and the thorium halos, which are well understood, very reliable. Polonium is a big mystery that's still being sorted out, but they focus on the anomaly and they ignore the stuff that's reliable. Oh, Larry Vardaman. No, he's a real scientist. Yeah, you know, he actually has a PhD in physics. Although when I did talk to him privately, he told me he had to go, I think it was 8 different institutions before he got his PhD. Not because he was having problems passing the classes, but he was trying to avoid those physics classes where he'd be confronted with challenges to a young Earth paradigm. So he managed to put together a PhD, because we kept asking him, you know, how come you haven't taken a course in classical mechanics? And he says, well, that was required for a couple of the institutions I was at, so I transferred. So, anyway. Let's see, there's a question over here. Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, Nevada is a bit precise. there are asteroids that we're watching, astronomers are watching, because they're possible colliders with the Earth. And I think there's one in the year 2023 and one in 2025 that does have a possibility of a colliding with the Earth. And these are asteroids that are, I think, about a half kilometer in diameter. Well, a half kilometer, that'd be like a third of a mile, and it would do a lot of damage. to give you an idea, if you go into Arizona, you'll see a crater there almost a mile in diameter and 350 feet deep. That was caused by a rock 100 feet in diameter. So, I mean, the point is these things hit at very high velocity. So something half a kilometer across, if it were to hit the middle of the U.S., would destroy a good chunk of the United States. Yes. No, it won't be significantly smaller. Once something that's big, it doesn't lose a lot of mass going through the Earth's atmosphere or traveling outer space. However, I want to tell you, in both cases, the probability of it striking the Earth is quite remote. The reason why astronomers are studying these things is they say we take out insurance for risks that are a lot less probable than this thing. So the risk is not zero. And actually, if the human species survives long enough, it's inevitable that we will be clobbered by an event like that. About every million years, you get a really big one. So, and you know, one like that hit in Arizona, that happens every 10,000 years on the average. Yeah, John. Well, that's an interesting point, because whether you believe that the creation days are 24 hours or long periods of time, it's still God taking time, which should lead you to read the text and say, is there a reason why God would want to take this kind of time? And I think there's some real good answers to that when you look at all the creation accounts in the Bible. So, and the fact that he does take time doesn't make him less powerful. You know, the analogy I used in A Matter of Days is like a guy who can run a 4-minute mile that decides to walk to work. Now, the fact that he walks to work doesn't make him a less able miler. It just means that he had a different reason for choosing to walk as opposed to running. Okay, I think I saw one more hand. Yeah, go ahead. Right. 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 You could, and for what it's worth, one got published 3 days ago in the Astrophysical Journal. They did a detailed study of the Sloan Digital Sky Survey as it pertains to our galaxy, and they have found this stream of stars moving at high velocity through our galaxy. A very controlled flow, a narrow pipeline of flow through our galaxy. It's like a channel. And they were able to demonstrate that it was a globular cluster that was floating around in the local group that got captured by our Milky Way galaxy, and the capture process and went through the tadpole effect and wound up having all of its stars stripped, and now we see the stream of stars flowing through, and some of them aren't too far away. But by the way, your scenario about the sun forming in a spiral arm and getting exposed to lots of supernova, which is critical for us to get the life we need for advanced life, and getting rapidly ejected as a result, you got to have all that to happen, or there's no possibility for advanced life on planet Earth. If we stayed in the spiral arm, we would have been dealt a deadly blow by the objects in that spiral, and was critical that we got kicked out. But it's also critical that we got kicked out and put into a stable spot between two spiral arms. So you wanted to be kicked out quickly and then settle down, and so you need brakes on the system. And all that involves fine-tuning to get the brakes coming on the system at just the right time to prevent it to continue streaming out. So, yeah, marvelous that we are able to live on this planet, but I'm also excited that we've got people that are now understanding just how miraculous the solar system really is for the support of life. And hopefully we'll get some play on this press release, too, about the fact that our hope can't lie in this universe. If it can't lie in the universe, and we really do have hope, then there's got to be something transcendent. Okay, let's spend a few minutes. I was hoping we could finish this up, but we'll see how far we get. Here we go. I'm going to just skip all this introductory material and get us right down to the scriptures that we're studying. Here we go. Here's our scripture list and the rest of it. And we've been through Job 12 already. Ask the animals and they'll teach you, or the birds of the air and they will tell you, or speak to the earth and it will teach you, or let the fish of the sea inform you. Job 12, and Job picks this up again in Job 39. And by the way, this pertains to some of our discussion. You know, Hawking making the statement, we got to leave planet Earth because there's no hope here. Well, the animals actually tell us that we do have hope. And it's something we discuss in Job 39. Now, God has programmed the higher animals, the soulish animals, the birds and mammals, to want a relationship with us. Well, God did that so that in studying the animals, we would realize that we are just like the soulish animals. We have been programmed to seek a relationship with a higher being, every one of us. And so as you look at these higher animals, they instruct us and tell us. And the interesting thing about these higher animals, if they're not damaged by the sin of humanity, in other words, if they're not abused by humans and they're not hunted by humans, they strongly seek out contact with us. And I've told you stories about how when I was in wilderness parts of Canada where people have never been or seldom go, what you discover there is the birds and mammals want contact with you. They'll actually come right up to you. You can put your hand on them. You can feed them. You say, well, why don't we see that around Los Angeles? Because the creatures here have been abused by the sin of humanity, or they've been hunted and they've learned to fear us. As it says in Genesis chapter 9, God placed the fear of man upon the birds and mammals to give them an opportunity to survive. However, you can see a little bit of what they were originally like when you come into contact with animals that have not seen human beings. And you can see this powerful drawing they have to have contact with us, to receive affection from us, and remarkably, to serve us. And, there's been stories of particularly the higher birds and mammals where, for example, people have been drowning in the ocean and dolphins will come and rescue them. And hey, if you've got a dog, notice how excited the dog gets to make you happy or to serve you. They love to do that. Well, that's something that God has programmed in all the animals, but I would suggest he's also done that to teach us that we're programmed the same way. That God has given us this powerful desire to serve him, to reach out to him, to have contact with him, to receive affection and emotional love from him. What gets in the way? The same thing that gets in the way with these higher animals relating to us. It's our sin that's the barrier. So that's a couple of ways that the animals can teach us. There are more ways than that, and we studied that when we were in Job 39. How lowly we are and how minuscule we are in that context, and also to recognize what God has done in our behalf. And that should draw us to a state of humility. The psalm also speaks about how God uses animals to engender humility in human beings, and little children as well, to make us humble. And what's the point of all this? Well, there are many Bible verses that say that God resists the proud but gives grace to the humble. And so this is a psalm that tells us that God has created the heavens, little children, the animals, the stars, in such a way that we would learn the pathway to salvation. The heavens declare the glory of God. This is a psalm that actually stimulated our study in looking at the verses in the Bible that deal with general revelation and makes the point that God has given us two books, the book of nature as well as the book of the Bible, and this is the basis of the Belgic Confession, one of the great Reformation confessions of the Christian Church. Psalm 33, which will be the next creation psalm we look at, the word of the Lord is right and true. He is faithful in all he does. Not just faithful in what he records in the record of nature, he is also faithful in what he records in the words of the Bible, or pardon me, the record of nature. He is right and he is true and faithful in all he does. The heavens proclaim his righteousness, Psalm 50, and the point here is that the heavens do more than just simply reveal the glory of God. That's a teaching I find in a number of churches and denominations, this idea that the universe, the heavens, simply declares the existence of God and the glory of God, but this is a verse that tells us he does more than that. He uses the heavens to proclaim his righteousness. And the context of heavens is referring to all of creation. So his character and his plan of salvation, at least the outline of it, according to this passage, would be revealed as well. Psalm 65, verse 8, this is a passage we studied last time I was here a couple of weeks ago. They who dwell in the ends of the earth stand in awe of your signs. And a number of you who are missionaries made some comments along with me how isn't it interesting that people who are far from the Christian faith, far from the Bible, far from the church, are the ones who are most impressed with God's revelation through the record of nature and actually stand in awe of the miraculous power of God that has been testified of through the record of nature. Yes. That'd be a good thing to do. I mean, I'd be interested myself. How many of you in this class have ever done ministry in a foreign country, short-term or long-term? Look at all the hands. Okay. Well, maybe we could hear from some of you as, what do you think about this verse? You've been to places where people aren't quite as close to the Scriptures, although I guess these days you could argue that Americans are the ones that are farthest away from the church and the Bible, not the natives that are running around in New Guinea. Interesting thing about Papua New Guinea, it now ranks as the most evangelical nation on planet Earth. At last count, it was counted as 43% evangelical Christians. So we used to think about the heathen in the hinterlands. Well, actually, they're probably a lot closer to church and the Bible than we are today. Yes. Right. Well, I mean, even Stephen Hawking, he's saying we have to leave planet Earth because it can't support us much longer. Where is he putting his hope? In the creation, not the Creator. We're going to get to Romans 1, which makes that clear, that that's a propensity of every human being. We look at what God tells us through the creation. Instead of worshiping the Creator, we wind up worshiping the creation. But back to the original challenge. Those of you who have served in a foreign country, what do you think about this passage? You find people more receptive, that are a little more distant from the church and the Bible in terms of how they respond to the record of nature than those, say, who are well exposed. Any comments? Gee, I saw a forest of hands a little while ago, and all the hands are down. So it's something I certainly have observed when I've been overseas. I mean, I remember going to one part of southern Africa where we were speaking to Hindu students. It was an Indian population, and they were almost to a man and a woman of the Hindu faith. But the thing that was quite obvious when we got actually talking about it is they said, well, we didn't need you to come today to realize that Hinduism is not true. We recognize that Hinduism is simply incongruent with what we're studying in our science classes and what we're seeing in the universe and the record of nature. You know, Hinduism's idea is that the whole of creation is contradictory. But when you study creation, it doesn't look like it's contradictory. Everything seems harmonious, consistent, fits together. And on that basis alone, they said, well, we know it's not Hinduism. In fact, what a lot of them were saying is, you know, we know Hinduism isn't true, but our belief is, and our parents have taught us, that nothing is really true, and that Hinduism is the best of the untrue options. But within each one of them was a hope that they would find something that was consistent and true. And that was one of the most receptive audiences I've ever spoken to in the world, because all you needed to do was present to them the consistent theology, and they grabbed for it. And then we saw hundreds of people come to faith in Christ, literally after just a one-hour lecture. So, but they had an advantage. They saw these signs. They were awed by it and were ready to respond. Yes. So you've served in the Philippines? Right, right. So you found receptivity there. Yeah, good. Anyone else want to share? Yes. Well, I think what you're pointing out is when, you know, people are close to the land, they're aware there's a God out there, but they're also aware that that God is opposed by supernatural evil forces. I mean, so those of us in America that don't believe in demons, you go to Bolivia, you go to the Philippines, they know about this stuff. Right. Right. Well, I got another take on this verse, and that is that it's people that are close to the soil, close to the land, close to nature, that see these things. And I think that's borne out by statistics on who believes in agnosticism and atheism. It's urbanized people who are away from the land, away from nature, who have technology and a considerable amount of wealth. That's where you find the atheists and agnostics here on planet Earth. But people that are close to the soil, they're getting their living from agriculture, that are exposed to nature every day. In places like that, you find very few atheists and agnostics. It's just like what you've been testifying of. They know there's a God out there. They're not sure they can make contact with that God. They want to make contact with God. They need someone to show them the way. But it's people like who live in Los Angeles and New York who make the statement, there is no God. Well, if all you see is concrete and steel around you, you may not be aware of these signs in nature as readily as people who are not so exposed. Yes. Right, right. Well, I remember the look on Kathy's face when we were in Africa, and, you know, we needed to get some food, so, you know, we went to, and what they did is they would grab a live chicken, chop its head off, wrap it up for you, and give it to you, okay? So that brings you a little closer to the, to nature. And in fact, it's something that Fuzz Rana, my colleague, has commented on, because he gave that talk at EV Free Fullerton about death before Adam. And his point is that when you're urbanized, you're not exposed to that kind of thing. As you say, you get your chicken already wrapped up in a nice, neat little package. You don't even think about the process that the person went through to prepare that chicken for you in that state. But when you got to pluck the feathers off and chop the head off, then it's quite different. And his whole point is that people who are agricultural, as opposed to heavily urbanized, you don't see this problem in the church of saying God couldn't have had death before Adam of animals. It's people live in the cities that believe that kind of stuff. But the problem is, most American Christians do live in cities and get their meat prepackaged. And so they lose sight of these direct signs, yes. Entropy started when God created the universe. I mean, it's something you see in Romans 8. The law of decay rules the entire universe. And since you can't separate the space dimensions from the time dimension of the universe, when it says the entire creation groans, being subject to the law of decay, that means the universe all the way back to the creation event itself, the cosmic creation event. And it's certainly something we observe. When you look far away, and hence back in time, we do see thermodynamics operating. Right. Okay, a couple of questions there. What happened to the tree of life? Well, you can read about it in the last eight chapters of Ezekiel. Evidently, God did, in Genesis 3, send two angels to the Garden of Eden to prevent Adam and Eve from gaining access to the tree of life, lest they live forever in a physical state, which would have damaged God's plan for the salvation of humanity. Now, what Ezekiel points out, however, is that Tree of Life ultimately was removed from the planet. So it's not here on Earth. It was taken away. And Ezekiel tells you all kinds... I mean, I can't figure out the last eight chapters of Ezekiel in any kind of detail. So exactly where that tree resides within the heavenly realm and what God's going to do in terms of moving it to different places is not all that clear. You do get some insights about where the tree will wind up. You'll see it mentioned in Revelation 22. So you can check that out. But in terms of the Garden of Eden, this speculation, I've seen this in the young earth community, this idea that thermodynamics operated outside the Garden of Eden, but not inside the Garden of Eden. But what does the text tell you? It tells you that God caused trees to grow in the Garden of Eden. And the sun was shining in the Garden of Eden. And there was eating going on in the Garden of Eden. Metabolism was taking place in the Garden of Eden. None of that would have been possible in a physical context if you didn't have the second law of thermodynamics. Now, it is true that the garden had no thorns and thistles. And it's a place where the animals were at peace with Adam and Eve and with God. But that's because of who designed and planted the garden. I mean, for example, if you've got a garden in your backyard, chances are you've gone through that garden and pulled all the weeds out. But I'll tell you what will happen if you don't continue to pull weeds out. They come back, and the thorns and thistles will take over. So you say, what happened to the Garden of Eden after Adam and Eve were ejected from it? I think God allowed it to go fallow, which means within less than a year, it would have been returned to the state it was before God decided to plant it, weed it, and take care of it. So yeah, there were no thorns and thistles inside the garden. There were thorns and thistles outside. If he had not sinned, he would have continued to tend that garden in a way that would have kept it a very pleasant place indeed. mean, that's one job God gave to Adam, tend the garden, which means when you see weeds, pull them out. You see thorns and thistles, get rid of them. Well, what I'm saying is the law of entropy was there when Adam had no sin. Got access to the tree of life. So it means whenever you feel a little bit of decay, instead of reaching for Botox, you go to the tree of life. Okay? Well, there's a reason why God took it away from us. He did not want us to be delivered from the products of decay, because this whole process of decay is one of the tools that God uses us to impress His message of salvation upon us so we can come to Him. And there's very good reasons for the laws of physics being the way they are. And hey, a verse you can go to, Jeremiah 33:25. The laws that govern the heavens and the earth are fixed. So the laws that existed in the Garden of Eden exist today. Okay, let's see if we can get to a new passage. The heavens praise your wonders, O Lord, your faithfulness too. And so once again, this is a passage, Psalm 89.5, that's talking about certain properties of God. Anybody want to give some clues as to what properties of God you can get from this? I think we discussed this last time I was here, right? Did we get through this one? I think we did, yeah. What you can gain from this passage is that God is consistent. He is immutable, He is consistent, He is faithful. He's not only powerful, which is the wonders part, but He's dependable. So that's the message we get from general revelation. Not just from the Bible, but from the record of nature, we can discern that God is dependable, we can count on Him, He is faithful, and He is consistent. Okay, let's get to a new passage. The heavens proclaim His righteousness, and all the people see His glory. So this is just like Psalm 50, verse 6. In fact, what's interesting is the Bible says more about the heavens revealing the righteousness of God than the glory of God. Yet I find it interesting the church gives the attention to the glory, but not to the righteousness. That's actually repeated more frequently than the glory. But this adds another point here. The heavens proclaim His righteousness, and all the people see His glory. And I would suggest that those people who claim that the record of nature can't reveal God in any significant way, I think this passage makes it clear that in terms of people who have never heard, there's nobody who's never heard. Everybody has seen the glory and the righteousness of God. So no one can claim that, hey, I simply had no idea that this God was there. What about those who've never heard the Bible? I've never had a contact with a missionary. I've never had contact with a church. They have had contact with nature, and God does speak to them through nature. Yes, over here. Well, I frankly like capitalizing the pronouns that refer to God because, you know, it gives honor to this one that created the universe. I think why that practice has disappeared in modern Bible translations is that in the Greek and the Hebrew, they had no habit of capitalizing pronouns in any context. So to stay faithful to the original language, they don't capitalize. However, English is not the same as a Greek or Hebrew. We do have in the English language the exception where you do capitalize pronouns, and therefore I think it's appropriate to capitalize it. So my own opinion is that we need to realize that, yes, in Hebrew and Greek you never capitalize, in English we do, and this would certainly be an appropriate place to capitalize. But it's all a matter of, you know, how you go about translating. And what I do like about the modern translations, I mean, if you pick up this New International Version, for example, there's a couple of pages in the front where they tell you the principles of translation they went to. And I think in this particular version, they make the point that they chose not to capitalize the pronouns. It was a choice. So they're not trying to claim that this is something that was dogmatic from the original. They're just saying this is simply our translation choice. But yeah, I would agree. I prefer the capitals. That's why you see in my books I tend to capitalize, although I got a publisher now that doesn't want me to capitalize, so we'll see. All right, well, the publisher has a lot more power than you realize. I do not get my way with my books. I have never gotten the cover I wanted, for example, or even the subtitle on the cover. The publisher dictates what it says there. And there was one time where that got me into trouble, the subtitle for Beyond the Cosmos. I told him, this is going to cause problems. I said, no, it won't. Well, it did. So in the second edition, we fixed it. So sometimes in the second edition, you can get your way. Yes. Okay. How do the heavens proclaim his righteousness? We got a few more verses coming, probably next week, not today. I'm down to just 2 minutes, where we'll actually take you through certain scriptures to show you the specific ways the heavens declare the righteousness of God. I'm going to close the study out by giving a quick survey through what Job and Elihu labor to figure out in terms of the righteousness of God, simply looking at the record of nature. And what's interesting is all the key aspects of the plan of salvation they are able to discern. So in terms of God being righteous, you can get that. Now, I think to make this work, we have to generalize general revelation. Often people define general revelation as simply the record of nature. But general revelation, in my opinion, is something that's made available to all. Not everybody has a Bible, but everybody can look out at the creation. Likewise, everyone can examine their own conscience. And one of the passages you'll be studying is Romans 2. And Romans 2 makes the point that God has written his moral law on the heart of every human being. So in my opinion, that's general revelation, because every human being has had that law written on their heart. Well, I think it's easy to discern how that would declare the righteousness of God. There's this moral standard that's written on our heart, but in addition to that, God has given us a conscience. And whenever our behavior falls short of that standard, what do we feel? We feel conviction. What that conviction tells us is that God's standard of moral performance is one of perfection. So in terms of the righteousness of God, he tolerates nothing that's unholy. Absolutely nothing. If we fib, that's enough to get our conscience to go. And the interesting thing about the way our conscience works is it speaks loudest to us when we're doing our utmost to live up to the standards of the law that's been written upon our heart. I mean, those who don't care about their the law really don't feel that conviction to the same degree that those do. I'll tell you the time in my life when I really felt convicted was when I read this Bible and says, wow, this moral standard is really incredible. This is the best I've ever seen in any other holy book. I'm going to do everything I can to live up to that moral standard. That was the most miserable time of my life. Because that conscience was just screaming at me how I was falling short of that standard. Well, again, I think that's part of what it says here. The heavens, and that's the point I make here. When it uses the word heavens here, it's referring to all of creation. That, in my opinion, would include what God has written on the heart of each one of us. But we'll get into this in more detail next week. I think I just consumed the 2 minutes. This is Father's Day. I've got to cook today, so I'm not going to stick around much longer. And I know a number of you have things to do as well. Let me just close in prayer. Father in heaven, we thank you for this time we've been able to spend in your word, and we got much more to come in the weeks that follow. We also thank you, Lord, for the day in which we live, when every single day there are new discoveries taking place in the frontiers of scientific research that give us more reasons to believe in you as Creator, Lord, and Savior. Father in heaven, we're also living in a day when men like Stephen Hawking are making outrageous statements. But Father, I pray that you would give us the humility and the grace and the wisdom to respond to the things that are taking place around us, both in terms of what we read in Scripture and what we see in the record of nature, what we see coming from our society, our culture. Lord, give us the grace and the humility to use what's taking place around us as a way to channel your light, your life, love, and truth to people around us that don't yet know you as Lord and Savior. Father in heaven, I pray that even within this next week, many of us would have the opportunity to share the good news with people who don't know you and see them respond. So, Father, give us converts, I pray, between now and next week. In Jesus' name, amen.